CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon, you're to the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. My name is Kingsley Kipuri, and as usual, I'll be your host for the next hour. Before we jump into it, I would just like to point your attention to one very fun and interesting thing. Yes, I'm just showing off our new jingle. Greg Nicholson in the studio with me. What do you think? What do you think of the new beats?
I know this was a priority of yours for about 2 years since we started the show. So just for your sanity, I'm happy it's done. And it actually sounds fantastic.
I mean, it only took me about 24 months to get to it. I'm glad to say we were on budget. We didn't do so well on time. But, you know, sometimes it's just the outcome that matters. So I just wanted to make sure the outcome was right. So thanks for your feedback.
I think listeners should understand as well that you were key, you're integral in this process, sort of saying, you know, a little bit more bass there, a little bit more sax over there.
I want to play one more time, but I'm gonna just take a step back and we'll play throughout the show.
We'll work it in.
Absolutely. Everybody tuning in, thank you so much. As mentioned, it's a Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I'm Kingsley. I'm here with Greg. We've got quite a packed show lined up. Greg, how have you been doing otherwise?
Well, Kingsley, I think you and perhaps some of our friends and even perhaps listeners might know that I'm like kryptonite to technology. So often when I have smartphones, something will just go wrong. I'll lose them, they'll get stolen, I'll drop it in the toilet, I'm that guy. But I've just got a new smartphone, I'm back in the game, and it was actually so great waking up this morning, because I'm not sure if you've seen this news, right? So I just check my emails and on my phone and things like that. So I woke up this morning and I see the newsletter, the Daily Mavericks newsletter, just saying how I think is it Kelly Conway, the White House aide?
Yes.
Yes, the White House aide, denying President Trump's assertion that he was sort of spied on. What was this? Wiretapped,
yeah,
I think it was.
Wiretapped by the Obama administration.
So yes. She denied this, flatly said no, he was actually sort of alluding to that more in general, talking about observations and things like that.
Yep.
Yet in the same breath, suggesting that they might have been able to put cameras in the microwaves.
Yeah.
So not only that in our newsletter this morning, they see such a fun little fact as well, that did you know when Instagram started, it only had 13 employees? No, sorry, when it was bought by Facebook, only had 13 employees.
I did see that and I was amazed by how that was possible.
Then there's some just other little gems in here, apart from getting the news from like understanding the latest on SASA, understanding the latest on PRASA and other sort of government agencies and other sports and other news too. There's even this other little gem that Japan had a monster collecting card game as far back as the Edo period, 1603 to 1868. Isn't that fascinating?
That is something.
If you'd like to subscribe to the Daily Maverick First Thing newsletter or the afternoon thing, and we also have weekend newsletters, you can find that on the Daily Maverick website. Click subscribe to them all, and trust me, your mornings will be better for it.
Absolutely. Wonder what happened while you were asleep? You know where to find it. First Thing newsletter. Just click on dailymaverick.co.za, click newsletter, and you're good to go. Now, to jump into today's show, a couple of topics. First, we're going to talk a bit about Somaliland, a country not too many people know about, and their push for freedom and their striving for recognition, not only from the African Union, but from the international community. So we've got a state that is declared itself sovereign and is doing a lot of the right things, like its own governance, its own currency, its own security forces, but it's still hitting a lot of roadblocks on its road to be recognized as a fully independent country. Secondly, I want to talk a bit about Mozambique. Our neighbors have had some tension in the past between the two sort of largest political parties, RENAMO and FRELIMO, that date back to its liberation struggle, and some people are saying that the most recent truce that they declared and the peace talks, actually there's cause to be quite optimistic this time. So Greg's been, you know, reading quite a bit about that, and we'll speak a bit more about that. And finally, we're going to talk about Uber, that's been on the newspapers, and we've been talking about that over the past week, and that's been largely around clashes between the Uber drivers and between meter taxis that culminated in the blockage of the highway on the way to the airport last week. So we'll talk about Uber, the business model, and specifically what it means in a South African legislative context. This whole idea that Uber is not a transport company, it's a technology company. Are Uber drivers employees? Are they unfairly competing against the meter taxi drivers? We're going to dig into all that and much more. Okay. Firstly, we're going to talk a bit about Somaliland, as I mentioned. That's a country within the borders of Somalia that's declared itself independent, and we want to find out what's going on. On the line, we have the resident representative of the Republic of Somaliland to the UK and the Commonwealth, Madam Ayan Mahmoud. Ms. Mahmoud, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. I mean, as mentioned, you know, offline, this is not a story or a conversation that's been had, you know, so much in South Africa. So I'd really love to start really from the basics. And if you could just talk us through what is Somaliland and how did it first come into existence in sort of the region's colonial history?
Somaliland is an old British protectorate, and It had a brutal war with Somalia. We united with Somalia in 1960 after our independence, but that marriage was not really a happy one. And then after brutal war and killing of almost over 50,000 Somalilanders losing their lives, and much of the country being destroyed, especially the capital city, we have declared ourselves independent in 1991. So that's the short version of Somaliland.
No, that's wonderful. I mean, you mentioned that the marriage was an unhappy one, so to speak. Could you give us some details of what were some of the underpinning issues that made that collection or that union so volatile?
Somalia had after the union had a very brief democratic government, and in 1969 it has been taken over by coup by a military dictatorship, Siad Barre, who have actually stigmatized at the beginning Somalilanders, and that stigmatization just grown as and as years progressed, it became brutal and killing, political killing, disappearance, and you name it. And then Somalilanders have organized themselves under the banner of Somali National Movement, and have freed the country in 1991 and have declared Somaliland independent.
Could you talk us through some of
and
the...
After that,
continue, please. After, yeah.
So after that, we had the referendum. We had a new constitution voted by popular vote. We had five elections, local elections, parliamentary elections, president twice, and presidential elections. Actually, three times presidential elections, and it's functioning state now within African.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, that's quite clear from all the news coming from that region. And just lastly, just still talking about the Declaration of Independence in 1991, as you mentioned, could you just talk us through some of the logic by some of the leaders of Somaliland and people like you who are part of the representatives externally, the logic as to why there's a feeling that Somaliland is best left as an independent country? Basically, the logic behind saying, you know what, it's better that we do this on our own.
In fact, the question we have to turn it, and there is no reason for Somaliland to join Somalia again or to rejoin, because after we declared ourselves independent, it's functioning as a state that can protect its citizens, that can. So there is actually no reason why Somalia is trying to also recover from a long war and extremism, but there is actually no reason for Somaliland to join Somalia again.
I mean, you're right. I mean, the place that has its own currency.
It has its own currency. It has its own military, police, parliament, local councillors, elected president. So there is absolutely no reason for Somaliland to go back with in unity. And it will be very difficult now because the country have progressed for the last 27 years.
Hmm.
As an independent, although not recognized, but as an independent state.
Absolutely. I mean, you're right. There's all the markers there that, you know, anyone watching the situation would say this is a fully functioning country. So, which then begs the question, in your view, why do you think it's been so difficult to get the African Union and the international community to fully recognize Somaliland as an independent country?
It's, in fact, more a failure why Somaliland is not recognized. But more practically, it's safe, it's secure, it's no problem. So I guess the feeling of international community is we don't have to do anything if there's no problem. So that's the major problem, that there's no problem in Somaliland.
Hmm. And some people say that there's a worry that if freedom is granted or fully recognition is given to Somaliland, that it will give, I don't know, open the door for other movements around the continent, secessionist movements like Biafra, perhaps people in Zanzibar, people in perhaps even Mombasa in Kenya to say, hey, if they can separate, so can we. Do you think those fears are a part of the reason why the AU is reluctant to grant Somaliland that full recognition?
Not really, because Somaliland is within the colonial borders that that the African Union respect and accept, and so it's not a secessionist state like many of the movement that want to be independent. Somaliland is it's all British protectorate. It was a state before, and so it is it's a totally different case and a specific, very special and specific case. So that whole worry, it's not granted.
And what about the fear that other provinces in the region, like Jubaland, Hiranland, would also want to pull out, and that would lead to sort of a separation of Somalia along clan lines, where every sort of clan would just sort of form its own region? Do you think that? Do you think that's a valid concern that some people have?
No, not really, because all those mini states within Somalia are part of the Somali federal system, and there are no reason for them to separate. And actually, they're not asking for separation. And Somalia said it's different because it is so. All those states you are mentioning, they don't aim. They are not aiming for independence. And Somaliland, it functions really as a state. So we are not asking that something that we are not. We are already in state. We are already a functioning African state within Africa.
Okay. Ms. Mahmoud, you are the resident representative of the Republic of Somaliland, as I mentioned, specifically to the Commonwealth and the UK. Could you talk us through, I mean, the strategies that your government and you specifically are employing as you go to the UK, to the Commonwealth and other countries to try and, I suppose, mobilize aid, mobilize investment, mobilize recognition? Could you talk us through sort of your work and what exactly you're doing?
Our focus has been number one, that all what is going on in Somalia should not damage Somaliland to start with, and situation as it is should be respected. Somaliland is an independent, and if any support is coming to Somaliland development or otherwise, it should be talked to Somaliland government and not Somali government. Secondly, we have been focusing actually quite in African states also, like the country, like your own country, South Africa. And in fact, South Africa was a long time friend of Somaliland. It has since 2005 and fact-finding mission to Somaliland, which actually came with a report which says there's no reason and there's no legal reason not to recognize Somaliland. So I guess those kind of finding missions are what we need from European Union, from the Commonwealth, and assess the situation as it is, and just not not holding holding to an kind of scarily that Somaliland by recognizing Somaliland it will cause problems. No, that would not. And I think more people visit Somaliland either from Europe and Africa, that they will come to the realization that why not? It's actually already functioning as a state.
Absolutely, and I'm sure I can see Greg already wanting to take a visit over there. Now, Ms. Mahmoud, just turning the page a bit and wanting to speak about something you've been quite vocal about over the past couple of weeks and months is about the famine. So the region has been facing a very severe drought and famine, and you put out a plea saying that the world should not just watch. And secondly, what I'd like to ask you is, you're saying this was seen coming, we saw this coming. Could you please talk us through the famine and why you believe this was predictable and could have been seen coming?
So the drought, Somaliland did not have a proper rain for the last 3 years. We had a severe drought 3 years ago. But luckily when we had the drought, some regions of the country, people could go there and get feeded by its own people. But because the drought has been going on for the last 3 years and it has not been raining, everyone could see it coming. In fact, that's why Somaliland election, which should have taken place in March, has been delayed to November because of the drought. Half of the population is displaced. Somaliland is about 4 million people and 1.5 million are affected. So you can imagine half of Somaliland population is affected by this drought. They lost everything. They lost all their animals. And as we speak, people are starting to die because of lack of food, medication, but also diseases and illnesses because of the drought.
Absolutely. And Ms. Mahmoud, before we let you go, what is your, given the dire circumstances in terms of the famine being faced in the country, in the region, what is your plea to the international community and to anyone listening right now?
I would say just forget Somaliland. It's not recognized. We have to save people now. And international community should come in and if we don't save people now, it will be too late tomorrow. In fact, it is already too late for many people.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. If you're just tuning in, that was our interview with the resident representative of the Republic of Somaliland to the UK and the Commonwealth. That's Ms. Ayan Mahmoud. Some might say she's effectively an ambassador from Somaliland to London and the Commonwealth. I mean, Greg, just in the famine that she was talking about, before we move on to the next thing, just looking that up, the UN has announced it's facing its largest humanitarian crisis since the 40s, and there's over 20 million people facing starvation and famine. And I don't know, I think the more we talk about, we talk to Simon, I think we talked to Simon Allison briefly about this, and he said at least in Sudan and South Sudan, this was something that was seen coming, and that in the midst of the factional battles and the issues in Sudan and South Sudan, people saw this coming, and the killing of livestock, the burning of fertile land was used as tactics in the war between Riek Machar and Salva Kiir. And I think that my little monologue here is just to say, how do we get to a point where over 20 million people could be at risk of dying due to lack of food, and that's kind of normal. It's not the biggest thing that everybody's talking about right now, and I just think I don't know what to say.
It's shocking. I think one of the things that I find particularly worrying from that interview just now,
yeah,
is that Somaliland is, you know, an effectively a functioning state.
Absolutely.
And yet 1.5 million of its 3 million people have been seriously affected by this issue. Now, when we look at South Sudan, other parts of different parts of Sudan and different aspects and different areas around Somalia itself, I think it's extremely worrying, obviously, the dire situation that many people are in. But in regards to issues, particularly in South Sudan, it shows the consequences of failing to resolve political troubles.
Yeah. Okay. We're just about to change topic somewhat. We're just going to speak a bit about one of our neighbors, Mozambique. As I mentioned in the intro, something that Greg's been looking at quite closely and something that we've been following is the political situation, specifically around the two political parties in power and in opposition. That's RENAMO and FRELIMO. And their story of sort of peace and truth and threatening to go into open conflict has in a lot of ways underpinned the political stability and instability that we see in Maputo and Mozambique. So we wanted to just chat to somebody on the ground to really understand what's going on there. So we're just about to go live with Adrien Barbier, who's a journalist at AFP. Adrien, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you. Hi.
Hi, welcome to the show. I mean, Greg, I'll let you jump in there.
Yeah, we may as well. We don't have too much time, Adrien, so I may as well just jump straight into it. I think most of our listeners and many people around the world know a little bit about the 16-year civil war waged across Mozambique between the two big political parties, Frelimo and RENAMO, that ended in 1992. I think the statistics say it killed about 1 million people, displaced about 4 million. Can you just tell us about sort of the history of division in that period between these two different parties, and what were the key sort of differences that led to that drawn out conflict?
Okay, so you know that RENAMO at the beginning was supported by the apartheid regime in South Africa, but what's important to understand is that quickly they managed to convince the population, especially in rural areas, to follow them and to help them, because increasingly those populations getting tired of the Frelimo communist regime and the kind of authoritarian methods they were using. So towards the end of the war, and that's when you had the most killings, the population, the RENAMO had a strong support from the population, which means that at the end of the war in 1992, RENAMO appeared as the party that, and it's what they are still defending today, is that they were the one that managed to bring democracy in Mozambique and so that the country can hold multi-party election, which they did in 1994, even though it's something that happened almost everywhere else in the world after the end of the Berlin Wall. So since after 1992, you had 20 years of peace. Mm-hmm. RENAMO ran for every election. Every time Afonso Lacama, who is still now the leader of opposition, he's been leading RENAMO since 1979. At the time, he was 26 years old. So every time he ran, every time he came second, every time RENAMO said that the ruling party was rigging the election. This changes in 2014, mm-hmm. because 2 years before that, the old rebels took up arms again. They felt that they had been put aside during 20 years, that peace had been really very good for the Frelimo elite, that their businesses were flourishing, but not for the old RENAMO fighters. A main point of the 1992 peace agreement, which is still now a main point of the current peace talks, is the integration of old RENAMO fighters into the army and the police. This was not properly handled, and RENAMO said that the fighters did not access to top senior positions and were put to retirement very quickly. So in 2012, and what also changed a lot is that in 2010, you had these huge gas discoveries in northern Mozambique, which is now considered as the biggest gas reserves in all of sub-Saharan Africa, which can make over the next 10 years Mozambique the next Qatar. So seeing all that, Renamo all levels rebels went back to the bush. They took up arms. During 2013-2014, you had some clashes. And just before the election, there was a first ceasefire that enabled Lacama to run the election, of which he once again, after which, when he came second, he once again said he would not recognize the result, and have asked for, since then, a reform of the state structure to allow more devolution. And he's specifically asking that the governors be elected and not appointed by the president, as it is now, because after the election, it appeared that Renamo won in most of central regions, but was not able to govern because of the system of government in Mozambique.
Can you sort of break that down to us here in South Africa? People may not know about the Mozambique electoral system. You were saying governors appointed by the Mozambican national government. So that means Renamo and Lacama then lose out on power in areas where they might otherwise be able to win and govern these regions.
Yes, so basically, you have 13 regions in Mozambique. Basically, in each region during the general polls that last time took place in 2014, they elect at the provincial level some kind of provincial assembly, but this assembly is only consultative. It does not elect itself executive branch such as the governor. The governor is appointed by the president directly. So in the last election, Renamo came first, and now they have control of 3 to 4 provincial assembly, but the executives of all those provinces are still appointed by the president and of Frelimo members. So that's why now they want to change that, and to change that, there needs to be a change of the constitution. Mm-hmm. So that's what they've been discussing for the last 2 to 3 years, whether to change the constitution and how to do it.
And while these discussions have been going on and Renamo's fighters have gone back to their strongholds, can you tell us just a bit about what this conflict looks like? Because I don't think we hear so much press about it here in South Africa. Is this a low-scale sort of warfare? We know sometimes you hear reports of soldiers going in and committing sort of atrocities. We're hearing lots of reports of many people being displaced and having to flee over the border to Malawi. Just describe for us how this conflict is playing out.
So it's both low-scale and underreported. As you may know, Mozambique is huge. I don't know how it compares to South Africa, but it's really enormous country with not too much populated, 25 million people, and people are spread around, which means that most things can happen without the rest of the people, and especially the capital that is situated at the extreme south, know about it. And there are just not too much journalists up there. What the war looks like, so you have two things. You had two things until the truce that was declared by Lacama at Christmas. You had until Christmas attacks from RENAMO rebels on the main road in central Mozambique. So it's the National Road 1 that goes from south to north. And you had rebel attacking the cars and the trucks that were circulating on that road. So in February 2016, the government and the army put in place some convoy, so military convoy that were escorting the cars, which means that the traffic was really slowed down and the economy in that region was almost paralyzed. So on this road you had RENAMO attacking, and so it was not direct ambush but mostly shot directly on the cars, and this made a few deaths and some dozens of injured. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you had in the villages, in the rural areas, mostly around RENAMO bases, and the most important was in Gorongosa, which is in central Mozambique, and it's the place where Afonso Lacama, the opposition leader, has been hiding since October 2015, and so far nobody knows precisely where he's been, even though he managed to organize press conferences by phone. Around those areas, there's been some clashes, and there's been the army going in and trying to look for RENAMO people and trying to identify who was supporting them. And to the year of 2016, they were mostly asking everybody to leave. That's why you had this wave of refugees and displaced persons. So in December, you had, according to United Nations, 8,000 refugees in both Malawi and Zimbabwe. And you had way more internally displaced. Mm-hmm. That some of them were accumulated in government camps and others were in host families. In parallel of this situation on the ground, you have executions, so assassinations of mostly RENAMO members and RENAMO figures, and you also had the same thing with some Frelimo members as a retaliation. Those executions are led by what people call here the death squads. It's apparently, because obviously it has not been proven, highly skilled, highly trained assassins that burst and have a list of people to eliminate.
Wow, that is actually extremely scary. Adrian, just because we don't have too much more time, I want to turn quickly to the peace negotiations. It's been 2 years. We've had mediators, international mediators, who have now come and gone. What have been the key disputes holding up any progress on this issue?
Yeah, so besides the mediation, you have the peace dialogue that has actually started in 2012, even before the first clashes occurred. So at first they were discussing just the problem of how to integrate RENAMO fighters in the army and the police, and in a way try to find a better situation to them, like some kind of golden retreat. After the 2014 election, the second topic was the decentralization and the state organization system. So as of now, and that was the latest method that's been chosen and implemented since early February, we have two working groups. One is focusing on decentralization. The other one is focusing on military topics. It's been coming and going because first they could not agree on how to properly integrate those Renamo fighters. Renamo was saying they want to basically have a number of posts that was granted to them, and the government was saying, well, first we need a list of all the fighters that you have. So this is why the first peace process ended, and now the second one has been more like taking length because of the decentralization, because Frelimo is quite against giving out positions like this. So last year in 2016, when you had international mediators coming in and the mediation that was chaired by the European Union, they managed to convince the government to at least allow provincial governors to be appointed by Renamo and elected democratically. But the people representing Frelimo, even though they managed to agree this within the peace talks, sometimes were not able to convince their own party. So you had this very weird situation of when the Frelimo representative would say okay, and then 2 hours later they would retract because it was not really approved by the party.
Recently, however, there has been a ceasefire. I think it's just earlier this month. There was another ceasefire agreed to between both Frelimo and Renamo. And there seems to be some optimism in certain circles that a peace deal could be reached this year. Do you agree or not, and why?
Well, to be honest, the ceasefire that was announced, first it was announced during Christmas, and it was unilateral only by Afonso de la Cama, was a big surprise, I think, to everybody. I don't know if now people are optimists. I think in the central region people are quite happy that you don't have attacks on the main roads, that people can go back to their homes. There were 20,000 children that were missing school, so the school has been reopening, so I think people are quite happy with that. I don't know if anybody here would risk saying that we would reach an agreement this year, because I mean the whole situation has been so uncertain for the last 5 years. It's really hard to say, to predict anything. The thing that's changing though is that next year end of 2018, we're going to have municipal elections here, and to some extent, Renamo wants to prepare for this and to be able to present candidates, because the last municipal election in 2013, they boycotted it, and it benefited to the other opposition party.
Absolutely. Adrian, thanks for the thorough breakdown, and we'll make sure to chat to you as the situation continues to unfold. Thanks so much. If you're just tuning in, that's Adrian Barbier, who's a journalist at AFP, who we're chatting to about the situation in Mozambique. Next up, we're going to be switching gears and talking a bit about Uber. You've been reading the headlines and seeing, or just living your day-to-day life and getting around, you must have noticed that there seems to be an increased tension between the Uber drivers and the meter taxis and these two industries, or these different players in the industry, one might say. And it culminated in the blockage of the highway last week. Greg, if I'm not mistaken, it was the highway around the airport where meter taxi drivers sort of blocked the road and said enough is enough. Uber competing unfairly and this can't continue. So we're just about to speak to Homotso Mokoena, who's a law lecturer at the University of Johannesburg, who's worked extensively in matters of labor law, who's going to talk us through Uber and how Uber sits in a legislative context in South Africa. Are they a technology company? Are they a transport company? Are Uber drivers actually employees? And lastly, talking about the situation with the meter taxis and you know, what's going on there. Homotso, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Hi,
Kendrick. Hi, welcome to the show. Now, firstly, in just reading your work, and you published something in the Industrial Law Journal, firstly, I just want to ask about these two words that I definitely didn't understand before reading it, casualization and externalization in a labor context. Could you talk us through sort of what those two things are and why those are two trends that people interested in labor matters are watching?
Well, casualization really relates to making the employment relationship less formal. So, for example, and it relates quite closely to externalization, and I think we've noted the phenomenon of labor brokers in the country, temporary employment service providers. They really are the sort of epitome of casualization and externalization. And the reason why an organization might want to make their employment relationship less formal by perhaps classifying a person as an independent contractor, for example, would obviously be to avoid the legislative framework that goes along with protecting employees in the country. So it becomes much easier to run a business, for example, if you don't need to worry about, the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, or the Labor Relations Act. How do you dismiss people? How do you appoint people? Do you need to provide UIF? You don't need to worry about any of those things if your employment relationship is less formal or non-existent.
Non-existent. Now, specifically coming to the sharing economy, is it fair to say that things like Uber and Airbnb and their business models have somewhat outpaced the legal frameworks we have, perhaps in the world, but specifically in the country?
I would definitely agree to that. Look, the sharing economy as a concept is much more about individuals sharing resources or making resources much more easily available to one another. So it's not necessarily supposed to work only in a business context. We're seeing it in a business context because of Uber. And Uber, the idea around it is that people can mobilize their dormant assets. You've got a vehicle, you don't necessarily use it 7 days a week, you can use it to make money. And you're sharing your resource to make money from other people, right? So Uber shows us that it's possible to use the concept of the sharing economy to make money. But it then sort of insists on an employment relationship being less formal or more external than it necessarily should be, especially if you look at our particular labor law legislation.
And you've mentioned in your writing that there's three particular conditions that are crucial to sort of Uber's sort of existence and their ability to be as successful they've been in transport. Could you talk us through that?
Well, okay, the first one in essence is basically that Uber has to classify itself as a technology company to avoid the legislation that comes with being classified as a transportation company. And that really brings us to the debate around the meter taxi drivers who have particular regulations that they need to follow. I'm not an expert on those particular transport regulations, but by classifying themselves as a tech company as opposed to a transportation company, they then avoid those classifications. The second one is they classify their drivers, they self-classify their drivers as independent contractors as opposed to employees. And again, just to reiterate my earlier point, it means that they then avoid the labor legislation that goes along with having employees in your workspace. And the last one is that they rely on a depressed labor market where people are really quite desperate for work in this country. So, you know, if you look at a jurisdiction like the United States, where Uber might be, for example, someone like me, a lecturer who doesn't work 7 days a week necessarily, or who doesn't go to the office 7 days a week, who may have time and a resource that I could use to make money. So it's in those jurisdictions, people who are using Uber are often people who already have jobs, who are not necessarily desperate for work, but Uber works best when people need the jobs, when people are desperate for the jobs, and therefore will take and accept any working conditions that are thrown at them.
Okay, so it sounds like Uber's case is pretty clear. We're not even a transport company. Our drivers are independent contractors, and they're helped by the fact that people here need work. So, I mean, yeah. You as, you know, someone, you know, who's in the legal world, is there a case to be made by Uber drivers to say, hey, that's not true. We actually are your employees, and therefore you are obligated to provide such and such protections or such and such support for us as employees?
I do think there's definitely a case for at least some Uber drivers to say that. It always will operate on a case-by-case basis, but I do think in all likelihood the majority of Uber drivers can be classified as employees. We've seen that in the case, the Bolero case that came out of California in the United States, same set of circumstances where Uber drivers insisted they were actually employees, and the court did agree with them. And that's really been the trend all over the world. Even in the UK, there are cases that have said that actually these drivers are employees. The sad part is that in South Africa, it looks like we might have to have an actual case, an actual matter, go through the courts, perhaps start at the CCMA, go through the Labour Court, maybe even go through the Labour Appeals Court and the Constitutional Court for us to be clear on whether or not Uber drivers are employees or under what circumstances they can be classified as employees. I think on the face of it, a good lot of Uber drivers will be classified as employees.
I mean, that's massive, and I can just imagine how big that would be for a lot of drivers who, at least in informal conversations, are saying, sure, you get a lot of trips, but there's a lot of things lacking from their relationship, as you might say, an employment relationship with Uber. Now, you know, changing topics slightly, is the other conversation that we've had, which is the Uber drivers or the Uber as a company versus the meter taxi drivers. Now, you, when we spoke sort of offline, have been sort of quite interested in this, and you think that there is room here, and that government does have, there is, what should I say? You say that it's crucial that government needs to step in here. Let you speak in your own words. What do you think is the role of government in some of the issues that we've had and the fight between Uber and the meter taxi drivers?
Well, I think, okay, from the first thing is that I can't condone the violence that has characterized the protest action on behalf of the meter taxi drivers. I do think an ideal reaction in this capitalism that we've chosen, whether that's fortunate or unfortunate is another conversation, but in a capitalist country, we compete. And what I would have loved the meter taxi drivers to do right away is to, you know, develop their own application. And now the nature of businesses, it's tech-based. All businesses are competing online. So even your traditional restaurants are going through Uber. They've got their own delivery apps. Businesses that normally don't operate online are finding themselves operating online. It is the way we are competing now. And that's, you know, it's good or a bad thing, but really industries must catch up and keep up. But I do think that government has a role to play in making sure that Uber is actually operating in a competitive way. And by that, they should be operating. First of all, they should not be allowed to not classify themselves as a transport company. Government should be playing more of a hands-on role in ascertaining whether or not people who are working for Uber are employees or independent contractors, and not just allow the business to decide whether or not people are independent contractors or employees. Mm. Our case law is riddled with companies claiming that employees are independent contractors and getting away with it until somebody has a dispute. We know that this happens all over our country, and I'm not sure why government isn't sort of taking a hands-on approach when considering innovative business models, the way our markets or our industries are changing, and what that means for the employment space.
Is there a legal framework for that? Do I have to take Uber to court before that's discussed, or is there a framework that allows government to step in and say, hey, we want to look into this?
Well, I mean, in theory, government can do whatever they like. I think especially from a legislative perspective, government really needs to pay a lot of attention to the way business is changing and the way people are doing business. If you look at a company, you know, slightly off the topic, a company like Airbnb, what are the implications of having individuals rent out their private homes for accommodation? Does it mean that you then give up your right to a safe environment in a private space, because those private spaces don't necessarily have to follow hotel regulations or accommodation regulations like ordinary hotels and B&Bs? Do we then give that right up? So, I mean, what I'm saying is these business models raise a lot of questions that nobody seems to be engaging on and nobody seems to be answering at all. And to me, it's quite worrisome. And I think government should be taking a much more hands-on approach to protect citizens, in particular vulnerable employees.
Okay. Khumutso Mokoena, Law Lecturer, University of Johannesburg. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. No problem.
Fantastic. I mean, that, Greg, and we talked a bit about this offline, was the fascinating thing was that a lot of the news coming out of Wall Street and the States is that Uber is actually in really, really deep trouble. So, and I hope that's something we can talk to, you know, on future shows. I mean, firstly, it's just around money. I mean, their financials are not public, but, you know, a lot of insiders are saying that they're hemorrhaging cash. And as much as they're raising tons and tons of millions of dollars, that They're spending it on, one, expanding really quickly, and two, undercutting in other places where they established cabs, whether it's the yellow cabs in New York or places like here. They need to come in cheap to be successful, and so they're actually spending a lot, and a lot of people are pointing that out. And secondly, that the culture is actually quite toxic, and there's been a lot coming out of especially around female engineers and coders and developers and managers, of saying it's a terribly hostile place for women to work, and the CEO has been recorded berating drivers in the car, and there's just so much going on. And I saw this wonderful headline that says Uber is going to sort of be one of Wall Street's most sort of spectacular crashes in terms of pushing the boundaries of the sharing economy, pushing the boundaries of how we think about business and how we can use the internet for business. But that doesn't mean you're financially sustainable. So we might find out that the thing that's opened all these doors actually ends up not surviving to see the promised land. Anyway, everybody tuning in, thanks so much. That's the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Remember, you can download and share the podcast. And as always, we appreciate your engagement on Twitter and you sharing the podcast with all your friends and loved ones. We'll see you next week, 1 to 2 p.m., same time, same place.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. CliffCentral.com.